Chapter 46. London.
Hello, Alfred.
Hello, Helen. She smiled and kissed his cheek and said,
Oh, it's so good to see you again.
It's good to see you, too. She threaded her arm through Vickery's and placed her hand inside his coat pocket, the way she used to do. They turned and walked silently along the footpath in St. James's Park. Vickery did not find the quiet awkward. In fact, he found it rather pleasant. 100 years ago, it was one of the reasons why he knew he truly loved her, the way he felt when there was silence between them. He could enjoy her company when they talked and laughed, but he enjoyed her just as much when she said nothing at all. He loved sitting quietly with her on the veranda of her home, or walking through the woods, or lying by the lake. Just to have her body next to his, or her hand in his, was enough. The afternoon air was thick and warm, a breath of August in February, the sky dark and unsettled. Wind moved in the trees, made waves on the surface of the pond. A fleet of ducks bobbed with the current, as if lying at anchor. He looked at her closely for the first time. She had aged well. In many ways she was more beautiful than before. She was tall and erect, and the little bit of weight she had put on over the years was hidden nicely behind her carefully tailored suit. Her hair, which she used to wear down the center of her back in a blonde cape, was pulled back and pinned neatly in place. On her head she wore a gray pillbox hat. Vickery allowed his gaze to settle on her face. Her nose, once a little too long for her face, now seemed perfectly appropriate. Her cheeks had hollowed a bit with age, making the bones of her face more prominent. She turned and noticed Vickery was staring at her. She smiled at him, but the smile did not extend to the eyes. There was a distant sadness there, as if someone close to her had died recently. Vickery was the first to break the silence. He looked away from her and said, "I'm sorry about lunch, Helen. Something came up at work and I wasn't able to get away or even call you."
"Don't worry, Alfred. I just sat at a table alone at the Connaught and became miserably drunk."
Vickery looked up sharply at her.
"I'm only teasing you. But I won't pretend I wasn't disappointed. It took me a very long time to work up the courage to approach you. I acted so horribly before..."
Her voice trailed off, and she left her thought unfinished. Vickery thought, "Yes, you did, Helen." He said, "It was a long time ago. How on earth did you find me?" She had telephoned him at the office 20 minutes ago. He had picked up the receiver, expecting to hear anything but her voice. Boothby telling him to come upstairs for another display of his brilliance. Harry telling him Catherine Blake had shot someone else in the face. Peter Jordan telling him to fuck off, he wouldn't see her any more. The sound of Helen's voice nearly made him choke.
"Hello, darling, it's me," she had said.
And, like a good agent, she had not used her name.
"Will you still see me? I'm in a phone box opposite your office. Oh, please, Alfred." "My father is friends with your director-general," she said. "And David is good friends with Basil Boothby. I've known for some time that you've been pulled in."
"Your father, David, and Basil Boothby. All my favorite people."
"Don't worry, Alfred. They don't sit around discussing you."
"Well, thank heavens for that." She squeezed his hand.
"How in the world did you end up doing this?"
Vickery told her the story. How he befriended Churchill before the war. How he was drawn into Churchill's circle of advisers at Chartwell. How Churchill put the hooks into him that afternoon in May 1940.
"He actually did it in the bath?" Helen exclaimed.
Vickery nodded, smiling at the memory of it.
"What does the Prime Minister look like naked?"
"He's very pink. It was awe-inspiring. I found myself humming Rule Britannia for the rest of the day." Helen laughed.
"Your work must be terribly exciting."
"It can be, but it can also be dreadfully boring and tedious."
"Are you ever tempted to tell anyone all the secrets you know?"
"Helen!"
"Are you?"
she insisted.
"No, of course not." "I am," she said, and looked away.
After a moment she looked back at him.
"You look wonderful, Alfred. You're very handsome. This bloody war seems to be agreeing with you."
"Thank you.
I must admit I missed the corduroy and tweed, though. Now you're all grey, just like the rest of them.
It's the official uniform of Whitehall, I'm afraid. I've become accustomed to it. I've also enjoyed the change, but I'll be glad when it's over so I can get back to University College where I belong.
He couldn't believe the words had actually come out of his mouth. He had once thought of MI5 as his salvation. He knew now it definitely was not. He had enjoyed his time at MI5, the tension, the long hours, the inedible fare in the canteen, the battles with Boothby, the remarkable group of dedicated amateurs just like himself who toiled away in secret. He had once toyed with the idea of asking to stay on after the war. But it wouldn't be the same, not without the threat of national destruction hanging over them like Damocles' sword. There was something else. While he was well suited intellectually to the actual business of intelligence, its very nature was abhorrent to him. He was a historian. By nature and training, he was dedicated to searching out truth. Intelligence was about lying and deception, about betrayal, about means justifying ends, about stabbing one's enemy in the back, and maybe stabbing a friend in the back if necessary. He was not at all certain he liked the person he had become. Vickery said, "How's David, by the way?" Helen exhaled heavily.
"David is David," she said,
as if no other explanation was necessary.
"He's banished me to the countryside, and he stays here in London. He managed a commission and does something for the Admiralty. I come to see him once every few weeks. He likes it when I'm away. It gives him the freedom to pursue his other interests."
Vickery, uncomfortable with Helen's honesty, looked away. David Lindsay, along with being incredibly rich and handsome, was a notorious womanizer. Vickery thought, no wonder he and Boothby are such good friends. Helen said,
"You don't need to feign ignorance, Alfred. I am aware that everyone knows about David and his favorite pastime. I've grown used to it. David likes women, and they like him. It's a rather neat fit."
"Why don't you leave him?"
"Oh, Alfred," she said,
and dismissed the suggestion with a wave of her gloved hand.
"Is there anyone else in your life?"
"Do you mean other men?"
Vickery nodded.
"I tried once, but he was the wrong man. He was David in different clothes. Besides, I made a promise in a country church 25 years ago, and I seem incapable of breaking it."
"I wish you had felt that way about the promise you made to me," Vickery said, and immediately regretted the note of bitterness that crept into his voice. But Helen just looked at him, blinked rapidly, and said,
"Sometimes I wish that too. There, I've said it. My God, how thoroughly un-English of me. Please forgive me. I suppose it's all these bloody Americans in town."
Vickery felt his face flush. Helen said,
"Are you still seeing Alice Simpson?"
"How in the world do you know about Alice Simpson?"
"I know about all your women, Alfred. She's very pretty. I even like those wretched books she writes."
"She slipped away. I told myself it was the war, my work. But the truth is, she wasn't you, Helen, so I let her slip away, just like all the others."
"Oh, damn you, Alfred Vickery, damn you for saying that."
"It's the truth. Besides, it's what you wanted to hear. That's why you sought me out in the first place."
"The truth is, I wanted to hear that you were happy," she said. Her eyes were damp. "I didn't want you to tell me I'd ruined your life."
"Don't flatter yourself, Helen. You haven't ruined my life. I'm not unhappy. I've just never found enough room in my heart for someone else. I don't trust people very much. I suppose I have you to thank for that."
"Truce," she said. "Please, let's call it a truce. I didn't want this to turn into a continuation of our last conversation. I just wanted to spend some time with you. God, but I need a drink. Will you take me somewhere nice and pour a bottle of wine into me, darling?"
They walked to Duke's. It was quiet that time of the afternoon. They were shown to a corner table. Vickery kept expecting one of Helen and David's friends to come in and recognize them, but they were alone. Vickery excused himself to go to the telephone and tell Harry where he was.
When he came back, there was a ludicrously expensive bottle of champagne sitting in an ice bucket.
"Don't worry, darling," she said. "It's David's party."
He sat down and they drank half the wine very fast. They talked about Vickery's books, and they talked about Helen's children. They even talked about David some more. He never took his eyes from her face as she spoke. There was something about the remote sadness in her eyes, the vulnerability caused by her failed marriage, that made her even more attractive to him. She reached out her hand and laid it on Vickery's. He felt his heart beating inside his chest for the first time in 25 years.
"Do you ever think about it, Alfred?"
"Think about what?"
"That morning."
"Helen, what are you—"
"My God, Alfred, you can be so thick sometimes. The morning I came to your bed and ravaged your body for the first time."
Vickery swallowed the last of his wine and refilled their glasses. He said, "No, not really."
"My God, Alfred Vickery, but you are a terrible liar. How do you manage in your new line of work?"
"All right, yes, I do think about it." He thought, when was the last time? The morning in Kent, after composing a double-cross message for his false agent, codenamed Partridge. "I catch myself thinking about it at the damnedest times."
"I lied to David, you know. I always told him he was the first. But I'm glad it was you."
She fingered the base of her wine glass and looked out the window.
"It was so fast, just a moment or two. But when I remember it now, it lasts for hours."
"Yes, I know what you mean." She looked back at him.
"Do you still have your house in Chelsea?"
"I'm told it's still there. I haven't been there since 1940, Vickery added, jokingly. She turned from the window and looked Vickery directly in the eyes. She leaned forward and whispered,
"I wish you would take me there now and make love to me in your bed."
"I'd like that too, Helen. But you'd only break my heart again. And at my age, I don't think I could get over you a second time." Helen's face lost all expression, and her voice, when it finally came, was flat and toneless.
"My God, Alfred, when did you become such a cold-hearted bastard?"
Her words sounded familiar to him. Then he remembered that Boothby, taking him by the arm after the interrogation of Peter Jordan, had asked him the same thing. A shadow fell between them. It passed over her face, darkened it, then moved on. She sat very quiet and very still. Her eyes dampened. She blinked away the tears and regained her composure. Vickery felt like an idiot. The whole thing had gone too far, spun out of control. He was a fool to see her. Nothing good could come of it. The silence was like grinding metal now. He absently beat his breast pockets for his half-moon glasses and tried to think of some excuse to get away. Helen sensed his uneasiness. Still facing the window, she said,
"I've kept you too long. I know you should be getting back."
"Yes, I really should. I'm sorry." Helen was still talking to the window.
"Don't be seduced by them. When the war is over, get rid of those awful grey suits and go home to your books. I liked you better then."
Vickery said nothing, just looked at her. He leaned down to kiss her cheek, but she lifted her face to him and, holding his neck with her fingers, kissed him lightly on the mouth. She smiled and said,
"I hope you change your mind, and soon."
"I may, actually."
"Good."
"Goodbye, Helen."
"Goodbye, Alfred."
She took his hand.
"I have one more thing to say to you. Whatever you do, don't trust Basil Boothby, darling. He's poison. Never, ever turn your back on him."
And then he remembered what she had said about her one adulterous lover.
"He was David in different clothes."
"No, Helen," he thought. "He was Boothby." He walked. If he could have run, he would have. He walked without direction, without destination. He walked until the scar tissue in his knee burned like a brand. He walked until his smoker's cough sounded like consumption. The leafless trees of Green Park twisted with the wind. The rushing air sounded like white water. The wind lifted his unbuttoned Macintosh and nearly tore it from his body. He clutched it at the throat, and it flew from his shoulders like a cape. The blackout descended like a veil. In the darkness, he bumped into a brassy American.
"Hey, watch it, Mac!"
Vickery muttered an apology.
"So sorry, forgive me,"
then regretted it.
"Still our bloody country."
He felt as though he were being conveyed, as though his movements were no longer his own. He suddenly remembered the hospital in Sussex where he recovered from his wounds, the boy who'd been shot in the spine and could no longer move his arms and legs, the way he described to Vickery the floating numbness he felt when the doctors moved his dead limbs for him.
"God, Helen, how could you? Boothby! God, Helen!"
Vile images of their lovemaking shot through his mind. He closed his eyes and tried to squeeze them away.
"Bloody hell! Bloody hell! Anyone but Basil Boothby!"
He marvelled at the absurd way in which one part of his life had folded over and touched another. Helen and Boothby. Absurd. Too absurd to contemplate. But it was true. He knew it. Where was he now? He smelled the river and made for it. Victoria Embankment. Tugs hauling barges up the river, running lights doused, the far-off call of a foghorn. He heard a man moaning with pleasure and thought it was only his imagination again. He looked to his left and, in the darkness, could make out a tart with her hands inside a soldier's fly.
"Oh, good Lord, excuse me."
He was walking again. He had an urge to walk up to Boothby's office and punch him in the face. He remembered Boothby's physical size and the rumours about his prowess with the martial arts, and decided it would be tantamount to a suicide attempt. He had an urge to walk back to Duke's, find Helen, take her home with him, and to hell with the consequences. Then the images of the case began bursting through his mind, just like they always did. Fogel's empty file, Carl Becker in his soggy cell.
"I told Boothby!"
Rose Morley's exploded face, Grace Clarendon's tearful flight from Boothby's lair, the pelican, the hawk, Boothby's Oxford boy spy. He had the uncomfortable feeling he was being run. He thought, "Am I a hawk too?" Where was he now? Northumberland Avenue. He walked more slowly, listening to the pleasant growl of the late afternoon traffic. He looked up and saw an attractive young woman staring impatiently at the passing cars. It was Grace Clarendon. There was no mistaking her shock of white blonde hair and her blood-red lips. A large black Humber pulled to the curb. Boothby's. The door opened and Grace climbed inside. The car slid into the traffic. Vickery turned his head and looked away as the car swept past him. Vickery rode to West Hulkins Street. Night had fallen, and with it had come a drenching downpour like a springtime thunderstorm. Vickery rubbed a hole in the condensation on his window and looked out. Crowds of Londoners moved along the pavements like refugees fleeing an advancing army, huddled beneath raincoats and umbrellas, some turned inside out by the wind, blackout torches peering weakly into the wet gloom. Vickery thought of the strange twist of fate that had placed him in the back of a government car and not out there with the rest of them. He thought suddenly of Helen and wondered where she was. Somewhere safe and dry, he hoped. He thought of Grace Clarendon climbing into the back of Boothby's car and wondered what the hell she was doing there. Was it a very simple answer? Was she sleeping with Boothby and Harry at the same time? Or was it something more sinister? He remembered the words shouted in anger at Boothby behind the closed doors of his office.
"You can't do this to me! Bastard! Bloody bastard!"
Vickery thought, "Tell me what he made you do, Grace, because for the life of me I can't figure it out on my own." The car stopped outside the house. Vickery climbed out and, holding his briefcase as a shield against the rain, hurried inside. It felt like a West End theatre preparing for an uncertain opening night. He had come to enjoy the atmosphere of the place, the noisy chatter of the watchers as they dressed in their foul-weather gear for a night on the streets, the technician checking to make sure he was receiving a good signal from the microphones inside Jordan's house, the smell of cooking drifting from the kitchen. Something about Vickery's appearance must have radiated tension, because no one spoke to him as he picked his way through the clutter of the Situation Room and climbed the stairs to the library. He removed his Macintosh and hung it on the hook behind the door. He placed his briefcase on the desk. Then he walked across the hall and found Peter Jordan standing in front of a mirror, dressing in his naval uniform. He thought, if the watchers are my stagehands, Jordan is my star, and the uniform his costume. Vickery watched him carefully. He seemed uncomfortable putting on the uniform, the way Vickery felt when he dug out his black tie once a decade and tried to remember what went where and how. Vickery cleared his throat gently to announce his presence. Jordan turned his head, stared at Vickery for an instant, then returned his attention to his own image in the glass. Jordan said, "When is it going to end?" It had become part of their evening ritual. Each night, before Vickery sent Jordan off to meet Catherine Blake with a new load of kettledrum material in his briefcase, Jordan asked the same question. Vickery always deflected it, but now he said, "Actually, it may be over very soon." Jordan looked up sharply, then looked at an empty chair and said, "Sit down. You look like hell. When's the last time you slept?" "I believe it was a night in May 1940, Vickery said, and lowered himself into the chair. "I don't suppose you can tell me why this is all about to end soon, can you?" Vickery shook his head slowly. "I'm afraid I can't." "I didn't think so." "Does it make a difference to you?" "Not really, I suppose." Jordan finished dressing. He lit a cigarette and sat down opposite Vickery. "Am I allowed to ask you any questions?"
"That depends entirely on the question."
Jordan smiled pleasantly.
"It's obvious to me you're not a career intelligence officer. What did you do before the war?"
"I was a professor of European history at University College London."
It sounded odd to Vickery just saying it, as though he were reading from someone else's resume. It seemed like a lifetime ago, two lifetimes ago.
"How did you end up working for MI5?
Vickery hesitated, decided he was violating no security edict by answering, and told him the story.
"Do you enjoy your work?"
"Sometimes. And then there are times when I detest it, and can't wait to get back behind the walls of academia and bar the door."
"Like when?"
"Like now," Vickery said flatly.
Jordan had no reaction. It was as if he understood no intelligence officer, no matter how calloused, could actually enjoy an operation like this.
"Married?"
"No."
"Ever been?"
"Never."
"Why not?"
Vickery thought that sometimes God's coincidences were too vulgar to contemplate. 3 hours earlier, he had answered the same question in front of the woman who knew the answer. And now his agent was asking him the same bloody thing. He smiled weakly and said, "I suppose I never found the right woman." Jordan was studying him. Vickery felt it and didn't quite like it. He was used to the relationship being the other way around, with Jordan and with the German spies he had handled. It was Vickery who did the prying, Vickery who broke open the locked vaults of emotion and picked at old wounds until they bled, Vickery who probed for the weak spots and thrust in the dagger. He supposed it was one of the reasons he was a good double-cross officer. The job allowed him to gaze into the lives of strangers and exploit their personal defects without having to face his own. He thought of Carl Becker sitting in his cell in his drab prison pajamas. Vickery realized he liked being the one in total control, the one doing the manipulating and the deceiving, the one pulling the strings. He thought, "Am I this way because Helen tossed me away 25 years ago?" He dug a packet of players from his jacket and absently lit one. Jordan propped his elbow on the arm of his chair and rested his chin on his fist. He frowned and stared back at Vickery as if Vickery were an unstable bridge in danger of collapse.
"I think you probably found the right woman somewhere along the way, and she didn't return the favor."
"I say, ah,
so I'm right after all."
Vickery blew smoke at the ceiling.
"You're an intelligent man. I always knew that."
"What was her name?"
"Her name was Helen."
"What happened?"
"Sorry, Peter."
"Ever see her now?"
Vickery, shaking his head, said,
"No."
"Any regrets?"
Vickery thought of Helen's words.
"I didn't want you to tell me I'd ruined your life."
Had she ruined his life? He liked to tell himself that she had not. Like most single men, He liked to tell himself how fortunate he was not to be burdened with a wife and a family. He had his privacy and his work, and he liked not having to answer to anyone else in the world. He had enough money to do whatever he wanted. His house was decorated to his taste, and he didn't have to worry about anyone rummaging through his belongings or his papers. But in truth, he was lonely, sometimes terribly lonely. In truth, he wished he had someone to share his triumphs and his disappointments. He wished someone wanted to share theirs with him. When he stood back and looked at his life objectively, it was missing something. Laughter, tenderness, a little noise and disorder sometimes. It was half a life, he realized. Half a life, half a home, ultimately half a man. Do I have regrets? Yes, I have a regret, Vickery said, surprised to hear himself actually saying the words. I regret my failure to marry has deprived me of children. I always thought it must be wonderful to be a father. I think I would have been a good one, in spite of all my quirks and shortcomings. A smile flickered across Jordan's face in the half-darkness, then dissipated. My son is my entire world. He's my link with the past and my glimpse into the future. He's all that I have left, the only thing that's real. Margaret's gone. Catherine was a lie. He paused, staring at the dying ember of his cigarette. I can't wait for this to end so I can go home to him. I keep thinking what I'm going to say when he asks me, Daddy, what did you do in the war? What in the hell am I supposed to tell him? The truth. Tell him you were a gifted engineer and you built a contraption that helped us win the war. But that's not the truth. Something about the tone of Jordan's voice made Vickery look up sharply. He thought, which part isn't the truth? Vickery said, do you mind if I ask a couple of questions now? I thought you were allowed to ask anything you liked, with or without my permission. Different setting, different reason for asking. Go ahead. Did you love her? Have you ever seen her? Vickery realized he never had seen her in person, only in surveillance photographs. Yes, I loved her. She was beautiful. She was intelligent. She was charming, and obviously, she was an incredibly talented actress. And believe it or not, I thought she would make a good mother for my son. Do you still love her? Jordan looked away. I love the person I thought she was. I don't love the woman you tell me she is. Part of me almost believes this is all some kind of joke. So I suppose you and I have one thing in common. What's that? Vickery asked. We both fell in love with the wrong woman. Vickery laughed. He looked at his wristwatch and said, it's getting late. Yes, Jordan said. Vickery stood and led Jordan across the hall into the library. He unlocked his briefcase and removed a sheaf of papers from inside. He handed Jordan the papers and Jordan placed them inside his own briefcase. They stood in an awkward silence before Vickery said, I'm sorry. If there was some other way to do this, I would. But there isn't. Not yet, at least. Jordan said nothing. There's one thing that always bothered me about your interrogation. Why you couldn't remember the names of the men who first approached you about working on Operation Mulberry. I met dozens of people that week. I can't remember half of them. You said one of them was English. Yes. Was his name Broom, by any chance? No, his name wasn't Broom, Jordan said without hesitation. I think I'd remember that. I probably should be going. Jordan moved toward the door. I just have one more question. Jordan turned and said, what's that? You are Peter Jordan, aren't you? What in the hell kind of a question is that? It's a rather simple one, really. Are you Peter Jordan? Of course I'm Peter Jordan. You know, you really should get some sleep, Professor. Chapter 47. London. Clive Roach was sitting at a window table in the cafe across the street from Catherine Blake's flat. The waitress brought his tea and his bun. He immediately placed a few coins on the table. It was a habit developed from his work. Roach usually had to leave cafes on short notice and in a hurry. The last thing he needed to do was attract attention. He sipped his tea and half-heartedly leafed through a morning paper. He was not really interested. He was more interested in the doorway across the street. The rain fell harder. He was not looking forward to going out in it again. It was the one aspect of his job he did not like, the constant exposure to foul weather. He'd had more colds and bronchial infections than he could remember. Before the war, he had been a teacher at a down-at-the-heel boys' school. He decided to enlist in the army in 1939. He was far from the ideal soldier. Thin, pasty skin, sparse hair, an underpowered voice. Hardly officer material. At the induction center, he noticed he was being watched by a pair of sharp-suited men in the corner. He also noticed they had requested a copy of his file and were poring over it with great interest. A few minutes later, they pulled him from the queue, told him they were from military intelligence, and offered him a job. Roach liked watching. He was a natural people watcher, and he had a flair for names and faces. He knew there would be no medals for battlefield heroics, no stories he could tell down at the pub when the war was over, but it was an important job, and Roach did it well. He ate his bun, thinking of Catherine Blake. He had followed many German spies since 1939, but she was the best, a real pro. She had embarrassed him once, but he had vowed he would never let it happen again. He finished his bun and drank the last of his tea. He looked up from his table and saw her coming out of her block of flats. He marveled at her tradecraft. She always stood still for a moment, doing something prosaic, while scanning the street for any sign of surveillance. Today she was fumbling with her umbrella, as if it were broken. Roach thought, "You're very good, Miss Blake, but I'm better." He watched as she finally snapped up her umbrella and started walking. Roach got up, pulled on his coat, and walked out the door after her. Horst Neumann came awake as the train clattered through London's northeastern suburbs. He glanced at his wristwatch. 10:30. They were due in at Liverpool Street at 10:23. Miraculously, they would be only a few minutes late. He yawned, stretched, and sat up in his seat. He looked out the window at the bleak Victorian tenement houses sweeping past. Dirty children waved at the passing train. Neumann, feeling ridiculously English, waved back. There were three other passengers in his compartment, a pair of soldiers and a young woman who wore the overalls of a factory worker and pulled a frown of concern when she first saw Neumann's bandaged face. He glanced at each of them now. He always worried about talking in his sleep, though the last few nights he had dreamt in English. He leaned his head back and closed his eyes again. God, but he was tired. Up at 5 o'clock, out of the cottage by 6 so Sean could give him a lift to Hunstanton, the 7:12 from Hunstanton to Liverpool Street. He had not slept well the previous night. It was the pain of his injuries and the presence of Jenny Colville in his bed. She had risen with him before dawn, slipped out of the Doherty cottage, and pedalled home through the dark and the rain. Neumann hoped she made it safely. He hoped Martin wasn't waiting for her. It was a stupid thing to do, letting her spend the night with him. He thought about how she would feel when he was gone, when he never wrote and she never heard from him again. He worried about how she would feel if she ever discovered the truth, that he was not James Porter, a wounded British soldier looking for peace and quiet in a Norfolk village, that he was Horst Neumann, a decorated German paratrooper who came to England to spy and who had deceived her in the worst way. He had not deceived her about one thing. He cared for her. Not in the way she would like, but he did care about what happened to her. The train slowed as it approached Liverpool Street. Neumann stood, pulled on his reefer coat, and stepped out of the compartment. The corridor was packed. He shuffled amid the other passengers toward the door. Someone ahead of him threw it open, and Neumann stepped from the still-moving train. He gave his ticket to the ticket collector and walked along a dank passageway to the underground station. There he purchased a ticket for Temple and caught the next train. A few minutes later, he was walking up the stairs and heading north toward the Strand. Catherine Blake took a taxi to Charing Cross. The rendezvous point was a short distance away, in front of a shop on the Strand. She paid off the driver and threw up her umbrella against the rain. She started walking. At a phone box, she stopped, picked up the receiver, and pretended to place a call. She looked behind her. The heavy rain had reduced visibility, but she could see no sign of the opposition. She replaced the receiver, stepped from the phone box, and continued eastward along the Strand. Clive Roach slipped from the back of a surveillance van and followed her along the Strand. During the brief ride, he had shed his Macintosh and brimmed hat and changed into a dark green oilskin coat and woolen cap. The transformation was remarkable, from a clerk to a labourer. Roach watched as Catherine Blake stopped to place the ersatz telephone call. Roach paused at a newspaper vendor. Browsing through the headlines, he pictured the face of the agent Professor Vickery had codenamed Rudolph. Roach's assignment was simple. Tail Catherine Blake until she handed her material to Rudolph, then follow him. He looked up in time to see her replacing the receiver in the cradle and stepping from the phone box. Roach melted into the pedestrians and followed her. Neumann spotted Catherine Blake walking toward him. He paused at a shop, eyes scanning the faces and the clothing of the pedestrians behind her on the pavement. As she drew closer, Neumann turned from the window and started walking toward her. The contact was brief, a second or two, but when it was over, Neumann had the film in his hand and was shoving it into the pocket of his coat. She moved quickly on, disappearing into the crowd. Neumann continued in the opposite direction for a few feet, recording the faces. Then he abruptly stopped at another shop window, turned, and followed softly after her. Clive Roach spotted Rudolph and saw the exchange. He thought, "Smooth bastards, aren't you?" He watched as Rudolph paused, then turned and walked in the same direction as Catherine Blake. Roach had witnessed many meetings by German agents since 1939, but never had he seen one agent turn and follow the other. Usually, they went their separate ways. Roach turned the collar of his oilskin up around his ears and floated carefully behind them. Catherine Blake walked eastward along the Strand, then down to Victoria Embankment. It was then she spotted Neumann behind her. Her first reaction was anger. Standard rendezvous procedure was to part company, and quickly, as soon as the handover was complete. Neumann knew the procedure and had executed it faultlessly every time. She thought, "Why is he following me now?" Fogel must have ordered him to do it. But why? She could think of two possible explanations. He had lost faith in her and wanted to see where she was going, or he wanted to determine whether she was under surveillance by the other side. She looked out at the Thames, then turned and glanced down the embankment. Neumann made no attempt to conceal his presence. Catherine turned and continued walking. She thought of the endless training lectures at Fogel's secret Bavarian camp. He had called it counter-surveillance, one agent following another to make certain the agent was not being followed by the opposition. She wondered why Fogel would make such a move now. Perhaps Fogel wanted to verify that the information she was receiving was good by making certain she was not being followed by the other side. Just to contemplate the second explanation made her stomach burn with anxiety. Neumann was following her because Fogel suspected she was under MI5 surveillance. She paused again and stared out at the river, forcing herself to remain calm, to think clearly. She turned and looked down the embankment. Neumann was still there. He was intentionally avoiding her gaze, that was clear to her. He was looking out at the river or back up the embankment, anywhere but in her direction. She turned and started walking again. She could feel her heart pounding in her chest. She walked to Blackfriars Underground Station, went inside and purchased a ticket for Victoria. Neumann followed her and did the same, except the ticket he purchased was for the next stop, South Kensington. He walked quickly toward the platform. Neumann purchased the newspaper and followed her. She stood, waiting for the train. Neumann stood 20 feet away, reading the paper. When the train came, Catherine waited for the doors to open, then stepped into the carriage. Neumann stepped into the same carriage, but through the second set of doors. She sat down. Neumann remained standing at the opposite end of the carriage. Catherine did not like the look on his face. She looked down, opened her handbag, and peered inside. A wallet filled with cash, a stiletto, and a loaded, silenced Mauser pistol with extra ammunition clips. She closed the bag and waited for Neumann to make the next move. For 2 hours, Neumann followed her as she moved through the West End, from Kensington to Chelsea, from Chelsea to Brompton, from Brompton to Belgravia, from Belgravia to Mayfair. By the time they reached Berkeley Square, he was convinced. They were good, damned good, but time and patience had finally depleted their resources and forced them to make a mistake. It was the man in the Macintosh walking 50 feet behind him. 5 minutes earlier, Neumann had been able to get a very good look at his face. It was the same face he had seen on the Strand nearly 3 hours earlier, when he had taken the film from Catherine. Only then the man had been wearing a green oilskin coat and woolen cap. Neumann felt desperately alone. He had survived the worst of the war, Poland, Russia, Crete, but none of the skills that helped him through those battles would come into play here. He thought of the man behind him, reedy, pasty, probably very weak. Neumann could kill him in an instant if he wanted, but the old rules didn't apply to this game. He could not radio for reinforcements, he could not count on the support of his comrades. He kept walking, surprised at how calm he was. He thought, they've been following us for hours. Why haven't they arrested us both? He thought he knew the answer. They obviously wanted to know more. Where was the film to be dropped? Where was Neumann staying? Were there other agents in the network? As long as he didn't give them the answers to those questions, they were safe. It was a very weak hand, but if played skillfully, Neumann might be able to give them a chance to escape. Neumann quickened his pace. Catherine, several feet in front of him, turned into Bond Street. She stopped to flag a taxi. Neumann walked faster, then broke into a light run. He called out, "Catherine! My God, it's been ages! How have you been?" She glanced up, alarm on her face. Neumann took her by the arm. "We need to talk," Neumann said. "Let's find a place to have some tea and do some catching up." Neumann's sudden move landed on the command post in West Halkin Street with the impact of a 1,000-pound bomb. Basil Boothby was pacing and talking tensely to the Director-General by telephone. The Director-General was in contact with the 20 Committee and with the Prime Minister's staff in the underground war rooms. Vickery had made a patch of quiet around himself and was staring at the wall, hands bunched beneath his chin. Boothby slammed down the telephone and said, "The 20 Committee says let them run." "I don't like it," Vickery said, still staring at the wall. "They've obviously spotted the surveillance. They're sitting there now trying to figure out what to do." "You don't know that for certain." Vickery looked up. "We've never observed her meeting with another agent before, and now she's suddenly sitting in a Mayfair cafe having tea and toast with Rudolph. We only had her under surveillance a short time. For all we know, she and Rudolph have been meeting like this regularly." "Something's not right. I think they've spotted the tail. What's more, I think Rudolph was looking for it. That's why he followed her after making the rendezvous in the Strand." "The 20 Committee has made its decision. They say let them run, so we let them run." "If they've spotted the surveillance, it makes no sense to let them run. Rudolph is not going to make the drop, and he'll stay clear of any other agents in the network. Following them now does us no good whatsoever. It's over, Sir Basil." "What do you suggest?" "Move in now. Arrest them the moment they leave that cafe." Boothby looked at Vickery as though he had uttered heresy. "Getting cold feet now, are you, Alfred?" "What do you mean by that?" "I mean this was your idea in the first place. You conceived it. You sold it to the Prime Minister. The Director General signed off on it. The 20 Committee approved it. For weeks, a group of officers has toiled night and day to provide the material for that briefcase. And now you want to shut it all down? Just like that?" Sir Basil snapped his thick fingers so loudly it sounded like a gunshot. "Because you have a hunch?" "It's more than a hunch, Sir Basil. Read the bloody watch reports. It's all there." Boothby was pacing again, hands clasped behind his back. Head raised slightly, as if straining to hear something annoying in the distance. "They'll say he was good at the wireless game, but he didn't have the nerve to play with the live agents. That's what they'll say about you when this is all over." "Not surprising, really. He was an amateur, after all. Just a university bright boy who did his bit during the war, then turned to dust when it was all over. He was good, very good, but he didn't have the balls to play in the high-stakes game. Is that what you want them to say about you? Because if it is,
Pick up the telephone and tell the DG you think we should roll this all up now.
Vickery stared at Boothby. Boothby, the agent runner. Boothby, patrician cool under fire. He wondered why Boothby was trying to shame him into going forward when a blind man could see they were blown. It's over, Vickery said in a dull monotone. They've spotted the surveillance. They're sitting there planning their next move. Catherine Blake knows she's been deceived, and she's going to tell Kurt Fogel about it. Fogel will conclude that Mulberry is exactly the opposite of what we told him. And then we're dead. They're everywhere, Neumann said. The man in the Macintosh, the girl waiting for the bus, the man walking into the chemist shop across the square. They've used different faces, different combinations, different clothing, but they've been following us from the moment we left the Strand. A waitress brought tea. Catherine waited until she left before she spoke.
Did Fogel order you to follow me?
Yes.
I don't suppose he said why.
Neumann shook his head. Catherine picked up her cup of tea, her hand trembling. She used her other hand to steady the cup and forced herself to drink.
What happened to your face?
I had a little trouble in the village, nothing serious.
Catherine looked at him doubtfully and said,
Why haven't they arrested us?
Any number of reasons. They've probably known about you for a very long time. They've probably been following you for a very long time. If that's true, then all the information you've been receiving from Commander Jordan is false, smoke put together by the British, and we've been funneling it back to Berlin for them.
She put down her cup. She glanced into the street, then looked back at Neumann, forcing herself not to look at the watchers.
If Jordan is working with British intelligence, we can assume everything in his briefcase is false. Information they wanted me to see, information designed to mislead the Abwehr about the Allied plans for the invasion. Fogel needs to know this.
She managed to smile.
It's possible those bastards have just handed us the secret of the invasion.
I suspect you're right. But there's just one problem. We need to tell Fogel in person. We have to assume the Portuguese embassy route is now compromised. We also have to assume that we cannot use our radios. Fogel thinks all the old Abwehr codes have been broken. That's why he uses the radio so sparingly. If we broadcast what we know to Fogel over the air, the British will know it too.
Catherine lit a cigarette, her hands still trembling. More than anything else, she was angry at herself. For years, she had gone to extraordinary lengths to make certain she was not being watched by the other side. Then, when it finally happened, she had missed it. She said,
How in the world are we going to get out of London?
We have a couple of things we can use to our advantage. Number one, this.
Neumann tapped his pocket containing the film.
I could be wrong, but I don't think I've ever been followed. Fogel trained me well, and I'm very careful. I don't think they know how I deliver the film to the Portuguese. Where it's done, whether there's a pato or any other recognition signal. Also, I'm certain I've not been followed to Hampton Sands. The village is so small I'd know if I was under surveillance. They don't know where I'm staying or whether I'm working with any other agents. Standard procedure is to find out all the components of a network and then roll it up all at once. That's how the Gestapo deals with the resistance in France, and that's how MI5 would do it in London.
That all sounds logical. What are you suggesting?
Are you seeing Jordan tonight?
Yes.
What time?
I'm meeting him at 7 o'clock for dinner.
Perfect, Neumann said. Here's what I want you to do.
Neumann spent the next 5 minutes explaining in detail his plan for their escape. Catherine listened carefully, never taking her eyes off him, resisting all temptation to look at the watchers waiting outside the cafe. When Neumann finished, he said,
Whatever you do, you must do nothing out of the ordinary. Nothing that would make them suspect that you know you're under surveillance. Stay on the move until it's time. Shop, go to a cinema, stay in the open. As long as I don't drop this film, you'll be safe. When it's time, go to your flat and get your radio. I'll be there at 5 o'clock, exactly 5 o'clock, and I'll come through the rear entrance. Do you understand?
Catherine nodded.
There's just one problem. Do you have any idea where I can lay my hands on a car and some extra petrol?
Catherine laughed in spite of herself.
Actually, I know just the place. But I wouldn't suggest using my name.
Neumann left the cafe first. He drifted in Mayfair for half an hour, followed by at least two men, the oilskin coat and the Macintosh. The rain fell harder. The wind picked up. He was cold, soaked to the skin, and tired. He needed to go somewhere to rest, some place where he could be warm for a while, get off his feet, and keep an eye on his friends Macintosh and oilskin. He walked toward Portman Square. He felt bad about involving her, but when it was over, they would question her and determine she knew nothing. He stopped outside the bookshop and peered through the glass. Sarah was on her ladder, dark hair pulled back severely. He rapped gently on the glass so as not to startle her. She turned, and her face brightened into an instant smile. She set down her books and waved enthusiastically for him to come inside. She took one look at him and said,
"My God, you look terrible! What happened to you?"
Neumann hesitated. He realized he had no explanation for the bandage across his cheekbone. He mumbled something about taking a fall in the blackout, and she seemed to accept his story. She helped him off with his coat and hung it over the radiator to dry. He stayed with her for 2 hours, keeping her company, helping her put new books on the shelves, taking tea with her at the cafe next door when her break came. He noticed the old watchers leaving and new ones taking their place. He noticed a black van parked at the corner and assumed the men in the front seat were from the other side. At 4:30, when the last light was gone and the blackout had taken hold, he took his coat from the radiator and pulled it on. She made a playful, sad face, then took him by the hand and led him into the stockroom. There she leaned against the wall, pulled his body to hers, and kissed him.
"I don't know the first thing about you, James Porter, but I like you very much. You're sad about something. I like that."
Neumann went out, knowing he would never see her again. From Portman Square, he walked north to the Baker Street Underground station, followed by at least two people on foot as well as the black van. He entered the station, purchased a ticket for Charing Cross, and caught the next train there. At Charing Cross, he changed trains and headed for Euston Station. With two men in pursuit, he walked through the tunnel connecting the underground station to the railway terminus. Neumann waited 15 minutes at a ticket window and then purchased a ticket for Liverpool. The train was already boarding by the time he reached the platform. The carriage was crowded. He searched for a compartment with one free seat. He finally found one, opened the door, went inside, and sat down. He looked at his wristwatch. 3 minutes until departure. Outside his compartment, the corridor was rapidly filling with passengers. It was not uncommon for some unlucky travelers to spend their entire journey standing or sitting in the corridor. Neumann stood and squeezed out of the compartment, muttering about an upset stomach. He walked toward the lavatory at the end of the carriage. He knocked on the door. There was no answer. Knocking a second time, he glanced over his shoulder. The man who had followed him onto the train was cut off from view by the other passengers standing in the corridor. Perfect. The train started to move. Neumann waited outside the lavatory as the train slowly gathered speed. It already was traveling faster than most people would consider safe to jump. Neumann waited a few more seconds, then stepped toward the door, threw it open, and leapt down onto the platform. He landed smoothly, trotting a few steps before settling into a brisk walk. He looked up in time to spot an annoyed ticket collector pulling the door closed. He walked quickly toward the exit and headed out into the blackout. Euston Road was crowded with the evening rush. He hailed a taxi and hopped inside. He gave the driver an address in the East End and settled in for the ride. Chapter 48. Hampton Sands, Norfolk. Mary Doherty waited alone at the cottage. She had always thought it was a sweet little place, warm, light, airy, but now it felt claustrophobic and cramped as a catacomb. She paced restlessly. Outside, the big storm that had been forecast had finally moved in over the Norfolk coast. Rain lashed against the windows, rattling the panes. The wind gusted relentlessly, moaning through the eaves. She heard the scrape of one of the tiles giving way on the roof. Sean was away, gone to Hunstanton to collect Neumann from the train. Mary turned from the window and resumed her pacing. Snatches of their conversation of that morning played over and over in her head, like a gramophone record stuck in a groove.
Submarine to France. Stay in Berlin for a while. Passage to a third country. Make my way back to Ireland. Join me there when the war is over.
It was like a nightmare, as if she were listening to someone else's conversation, or watching it in a film, or reading it in a book. The idea was ludicrous. Sean Doherty, derelict Norfolk Coast farmer and IRA sympathizer, was going to take a U-boat to Germany. She supposed it was the logical culmination of Sean's spying. She had been foolish to hope that everything would return to normal when the war was over. She had deluded herself. Sean was going to flee and leave her behind to face the consequences. What would the authorities do?
Just tell them you knew nothing about it, Mary.
And what if they didn't believe her? What would they do then? How could she stay in the village if everyone knew Sean had been a spy? She would be run off the Norfolk coast. She would be run out of every English village where she tried to settle. She would have to leave Hampton Sands. She would have to leave Jenny Colville. She would have to go back to Ireland, back to the barren village she had fled 30 years ago. She still had family there, family that would take her in. The thought was utterly appalling, but she would have no choice. Not after everyone learned that Sean had spied for the Germans. She began to weep. She thought, "Damn you, Sean Doherty! How could you have been such a damned fool?" Mary went back to the window. On the track, in the direction of the village, she saw a pinprick of light bobbing in the downpour. A moment later she saw the shine of a wet oilskin and the faint outline of a figure on a bicycle, body hunched forward into the wind, elbows thrust out, knees pumping. It was Jenny Colville. She dismounted at the gate and pushed the bicycle up the pathway. Mary opened the door to her. The wind gusted, hurling rain inside the cottage. Mary pulled Jenny inside and helped her out of her wet coat and hat.
"My God, Jenny, what are you doing out in weather like this?" "Oh, Mary, it's marvellous. So windy, so beautiful." "You've obviously lost your mind, child. Sit down by the fire, I'll make you some hot tea."
Jenny warmed herself in front of the log fire.
"Where's James?"
she asked.
"He's not here now," Mary called from the kitchen. "He's out with Sean somewhere."
"Oh," Jenny said, and Mary could hear the disappointment in her voice.
"Will he be back soon?"
Mary stopped what she was doing and went back into the living room. She looked at Jenny and said,
"Why are you so concerned about James all of a sudden?" "I just wanted to see him, say hello, spend some time with him, that's all." "That's all? What in the world has got into you, Jenny?" "I just like him, Mary. I like him very much. And he likes me." "You like him, and he likes you. Where did you get an idea like that?" "I know, Mary, believe me. Don't ask me how I know it, but I do."
Mary took hold of her by the shoulders.
"Listen to me, Jenny."
She shook Jenny once.
"Are you listening to me?" "Yes, Mary, you're hurting me." "Stay away from him. Forget about him."
Jenny began to cry.
"I can't forget about him, Mary. I love him. And he loves me. I know he does." "Jenny, he doesn't love you. Don't ask me to explain it all now, because I can't, my love. He's a kind man, but he's not what he appears to be. Let go of it. Forget about him. You have to trust me, little one. He's not one for you."
Jenny tore herself from Mary's grasp, stood back and wiped the tears off her face.
"He is for me, Mary. I love him. You've been trapped here with Sean so long you've forgotten what love is."
Then she picked up her coat and dashed out the front door, slamming it behind her. Mary hurried to the window and watched Jenny pedaling away through the storm. Rain beat against Jenny's face as she pedaled along the rolling track toward the village. She had told herself she would not cry again, but she had not been able to keep her word. Tears mixed with the rain and streamed down her face. The village was tightly shuttered, the village store and the pub closed for the night, blackout shades drawn in the cottages. Her torch was lying in her basket, its pale yellow beam aimed forward into the pitch darkness. It was barely enough light to see by. She passed through the village and started toward her cottage. She was furious with Mary. How dare she try to come between her and James?
And what did she mean by that remark about him?
He's not what he appears to be.
She was also angry with herself. She felt terrible about the insult she had hurled at Mary as she ran out the door. They had never quarrelled before. In the morning, when things calmed down, Jenny would go back and apologize. In the distance, she could make out the outline of their cottage against the sky. She dismounted at the gate, pushed her bicycle up the footpath, and leaned it against the side of the cottage. Her father came out and stood in the doorway, wiping his hands on a rag. His face was still swollen from the fight. Jenny tried to push past him, but he reached out and wrapped his hands around her arm in an iron grip.
"Have you been with him again?"
"No, Papa," she cried out in pain. "Please, you're hurting my arm."
He raised his other hand to strike her, his ugly, swollen face contorted with rage.
"Tell me the truth, Jenny. Have you been with him again?"
"No, I swear,"
she cried, her arms raised about her face to ward off the blow she expected at any second.
"Please, Papa, don't hit me. I'm telling you the truth."
Martin Colville released his grip.
"Go inside and make me some supper."
She wanted to scream, "Make your own bloody supper for a change," but she knew where it would lead. She looked at his face and for an instant found herself wishing that James had killed him. This is the last time, she thought. This is the very last time. She went inside, removed her sodden coat, hung it on the wall in the kitchen, and started his dinner.